This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
So, hello and welcome to the second episode of the Urban Political podcast mini-series on cities and geopolitics that we are producing in collaboration with the Second Cold War Observatory and the Urban Geography Journal. I will be co-hosting today's episode with my colleague, Gareth Fien. Hi, Gareth, and thanks for joining, and thanks for doing this together. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be co-hosting.
So in the last episode, we had a spirited conversation with Seth Schindler and Kevin Ward on the new geopolitical conjuncture that we find ourselves in the midst of, what it means for cities and extended urbanization, let's say, that spans the world. Among other things, Kevin mentioned about military urbanism that emerged in after the Second Cold War in relation to the work of one of our speakers today, which I will introduce later, Simon Marwin. The realities today are much more complex and we need new grammars for this. And Seth mentioned how it is practically impossible to think of cities today without thinking of geopolitical rivalry. In today's episode, we'll be unpacking another part of this puzzle, namely how infrastructures ranging from semiconductor production to energy grids have become central to geopolitical competition. Gareth and I are joined by three scholars whose research focuses on this subject, and they will help us understand the connection between urban infrastructure power and geopolitics better. So our first guest today is Professor Simon Marwin. He's a professor in the Urban Institute at University of Sheffield and in the School of Architecture and Design and Planning at Sydney University. Simon worked at Newcastle, Salford, Durham universities before joining Sheffield in 2015 and Sydney in 2020. Overall, his work analyzes the changing relations between infrastructure and the urban condition and explores social, economic, material interrelationships across diverse technologies in different urban contexts. The key outputs have significantly influenced architecture, human geography, and technology studies, environmental studies, and urban planning research. His latest co-authored book, rather, not co-authored, with Andres Luque Ayala, is called Urban Operating Systems Producing the Computational City. It was published by MIT Press in 2020 and is freely available as an open access publication. His recent work focuses on interior climate control, urban AI and robotics, and urbanization of neurotechnology. Thanks for joining us, Simon.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
Our second guest, Emily Conrad, is a PhD candidate in international politics at the Fudan University in Shanghai. Her work focuses on US-China relations at the subnational level. She attended Wofford College in her hometown of Spartanburg, South Carolina, where she graduated summa cum laude with a triple major in economics, German, and Spanish, and the distinction Phi Beta Kappa. She completed her master's degree from Peking University in Beijing, where she is a Yenching Academy Fellow. A former journalist, she's the author of the book Faithless, The Untold Story of the Electoral College. Thanks for joining us, Emily.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Last but not least, we have Justin Kohler. He's an American planner and incoming assistant professor at the National University of Singapore. His research focuses on the territorial politics of semiconductor factories and AI data centers, showing how these massive projects transformed land markets and energy systems. Kohler tracks how geopolitical competition takes material form in cities across US and Asia by examining the links between high-tech industrial policy, AI land and resource use, finance and fossil capital. Welcome to the podcast and thanks for joining us today. Welcome, Justin.
Thanks for having me.
So, Gareth, maybe I pass the mic to you and you can take us into the first question.
Yeah, sure. Okay, yeah. So I guess the first thing we wanted to start with was, yeah, building on the previous episode as well, is this how this question of kind of infrastructures, obviously in the last 20 years or so, there's been a lot of writing about infrastructures and urbanism, but I guess what we really wanted to talk about is how these infrastructures are becoming geopolitical assets. We could start with Simon, if you want to get us started on that, then we'll go around.
Yeah, thank you, Gareth. That's a great question. I mean, what interests me is during the Cold War, most major infrastructures followed a military-first trajectory. So classically, technologies were developed within the military defense industrial complex and later diffused into civilian applications. I'm thinking here of the internet, GPS, other sorts of technologies that were linked back, particularly in the US, to the role of DARPA. And I think we're seeing in the current period, I'm increasingly convinced we're seeing a reversal of that military-first logic, and that key urban technologies are now civilian-first but military-ready. They're developed, deployed, and normalized in urban contexts, and only subsequently translated into military and security applications. So I think cities are no longer downstream recipients of geopolitical technologies. They're upstream laboratories where those are formed, and that infrastructure becomes a geopolitical asset in three ways, basically. Through data capture, urban populations generate enormous amounts of behavioral environmental data, which become strategic resources of interest to state and military actors. Secondly, through standards and platform technologies, big tech firms like Microsoft and Google, or large Chinese platform ecosystems, they shape technical architectures that others must adopt. And thirdly, finally, is through operational integration. Civilian infrastructures of logistics, mobility, communications, drones, automated vehicles can be repurposed and extended into security and military domains. And I think infrastructure is no longer a support for the city. It's a sort of strategic terrain that's now of interest to really quite strategic security and military actors.
Great. Thanks, Owen. Annalie, do you want to come in next?
Yes, I would. So my dissertation research focuses on subnational reactions in the United States to Chinese manufacturing investments in particular. And I think that because of that, I can kind of share some on the ground insights into this. I looked in particular into the states of South Carolina, Virginia, and Michigan, all of which have had Chinese investments in manufacturing. I think that one of the things that has kind of gotten lost in this is that actually Chinese companies have embedded themselves into the U.S. supply chains and into the U.S. market for actually a long time. In this post-Cold War liberalism, you started to see Chinese companies come over even in the early 90s. Yes, in the early 90s, they started out as after-sales support. You have the first greenfield manufacturing investment that came in 1999 when Haier opened up a refrigerator factory in Camden, South Carolina. And you have examples where Chinese companies or Hong Kong listed companies like Tektronix Industries purchased Ryobi's power tool business. And I mean, when they did that, they were immediately the employers of like 700 people in a small town. So what I'm trying to say is that infrastructure has just kind of, and these systems has just kind of more recently become geopolitical through reinterpretation and context is kind of the main point I'm trying to get to here. And one of the things that I think has also been lost in this is that state governments actually recruited Chinese companies to come in and create jobs for nearly two decades. So between 2000 and 2020, you actually saw an entire state-level economic development infrastructure going into China, trying to attract these investments and bring them in. It's really in this COVID and post-COVID that you start to see federal narrative shifts and these state-level governments and these local-level governments start trying to align themselves within these federal narratives. Another example of this is also, and we can get into this later, is that in all three might be dissertation case studies. They all actually have shut down their China investment attraction mechanisms and trade attraction mechanisms, and they've opened up these offices in Taiwan instead, arguably all going after the same types of investments and really creating maybe even this race to the bottom of trying to attract you know, one big fish into their state economy. I would venture to say that geopolitics can basically repurpose existing systems and infrastructure. And I would be interested in what everybody else has seen in their research and if we can build off of that some.
Great. Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting. And I think something that struck me yesterday in the episode that came out yesterday was this idea that, contrasting to the kind of First Cold War, that there was these two separate spheres of influence, and actually the sort of development of, I guess, of this sort of Second Cold War is actually one where many countries are modern. There's not both countries are both China and the US, right? Like, for different things, but these two things like overlapped and brought together. And I guess that also, I guess, speaks to the sort of civilian first aspect of this as well. Justin, I mean, let me hand over to you.
Yeah, just to kind of dovetail off of both of the comments by Simon and Emily, I think the problem of supply chains really kind of sits very central to how geopolitics has played out very recently and also throughout history. If we look at some of the high-tech supply chains that Simon Marvin was alluding to, semiconductor manufacturing is one of these things that emerged just after COVID-19 when there was bottlenecks and other problems within the economy during that time. But through things like the CHIPS Act in 2022, rhetoric surrounding Chinese threats to U.S. technological hegemony or technological power or prowess became much more prevalent in the kind of policymaking spheres. And a lot of that rhetoric was inserted into the CHIPS Act and the rationale for why the U.S. needed to reshore a lot of their semiconductor production or friendshore them outside of China into friendlier nations. Like, this includes Taiwan, where a lot of semiconductor production was already located. But behind that was also the idea that these more advanced chips underwrote some of the ambitions of the military-industrial complex in the United States, but also the ambitions of many of the largest firms in the US that we see today pursuing AI expansion in data centers. Is it the kind of the Googles, the Amazon, Microsoft, et cetera, that are at the top of the S&P 500. So all of this sort of has coalesced in the United States to really kind of foreground US-China competition and has become an important rationale, not only for national actors, but for state actors and in urban or city actors to look to attract new investment, both in semiconductor manufacturing and other high-tech supply chains or industries. But now increasingly, looking to use that kind of geopolitical competition rhetoric to justify the expansion of AI data centers. And with that, I think the more important infrastructure question is all of these systems require immense amounts of energy and water and land. And that's sort of where the question of, you know, do we need to build out energy systems? How do we deal with the kind of distributional problems that come with water, access to water, between agriculture, data centers, semiconductor fabs, et cetera. And those start to become both local questions of how do we deal with this, but also project upward to geopolitical problems. How are these interests being balanced between national security rationales or national competitiveness rationales versus local economic development and sustainability?
Thanks for that, Justin. I wanted to come in with a second question, which is what forms of control and dependency do these sort of infrastructures produce? So, Simon, you highlighted like the difference between the previous conjunctures and the current one. So perhaps maybe we could start with you and Emily and Justin again.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's three main differences during the current period. Urban infrastructure has reorganized power now in quite different ways. And I think there's three dimensions that are particularly important is the sort of infrastructural dependency of urban contexts. So the cities are increasingly reliant on external platform and commercial vendors to operate core city systems, which is a major shift from public or private monopolies of the Cold War period. And it really strategically places, you know, US and particularly Chinese companies in really powerful positions. I think they produce a form of data dependency. So control increasingly lies with those organizations, like mainly commercial entities, that are able to aggregate and model urban data rather than municipal authorities. They have some, may have some role in this, but increasingly there's other corporate intermediaries or even state agencies, military agencies, that are able to, in a sense, govern territory through that data. And I think the third one, which I think is really overlooked, is the way in which urban infrastructures, particularly the new urban infrastructures, robotics, automation, AI, drones, produce a sort of form of behavioral and cognitive conditioning. And I think I'm increasingly struck by the way in which populations are becoming accustomed to dealing with automated systems in airports, shops, retailing, banking, increasing demands that are placed on humans to interact with machinery in ways that we couldn't have thought about 20 years ago. And the role of robotics and automation in real-time monitoring and intervention, you know, automated policing, robots in whole sort of different domains of urban life. And I think from a military and security perspective, this matters enormously. This is about not just about the piloting and development of these technological systems themselves, but it's the preconditioning of urban populations to become familiar with using and living alongside these sorts of technologies before they're used in a wide sort of large scale in military contexts. So if you just take, for example, drones are introduced for delivery, infrastructure inspection, but they also establish new models of airspace control and coordination, drone swarms, for example. Autonomous vehicles reshape urban logistics and mobility, but they feed directly into military thinking about convoy automation in contested environments. Human-machine teaming emerges in workplace, and military are really interested in the parallels of that for integrating soldiers into coordinated battlefield control systems. We need to think about this sort of dual use in a different way. This is about the increasing interconnection and blurring of the boundary between civil and military context, and the sense in which the city becomes a test environment for these operational systems.
Thank you, Simon. Emily, do you want to come in?
Yes, I would. When we talk about U.S.-China relations and the increased securitization, especially around investments, there's just a lot of attention that is put in particular on the federal level. I mean, you have the CFIUS, which is basically the investment screening mechanism for all Chinese investments coming in. And I think that there's an overfocus on this. And one of the things that gets very much lost in this discussion is the fact that you have so many state and local level actions going on at the moment. And actually, there's a lot of agency that these local level players have. And that's interesting to think about. And I come from it as an IR scholar in the field of geopolitics, to think that there is so much agency at this local level. So, for example, many states are actively considering or have already passed land restrictions. This would mean that Chinese individuals and companies would not be able to purchase property. Of course, that means that they couldn't open up a factory if they did that. Texas is considering its own state-level CFIUS mechanism. In the case of Goshen in Michigan, you even had a local-level ordinance that basically brought that investment to a grinding halt. Now, this is one of the things that's happening, but in the midst of my field research, one of the things that really stuck with me is that you are still actively having Chinese firms and investment coming into the United States, and they're driven by market incentives, and they're often doing it under the radar. And when we talk about Chinese firms and Chinese firms operating in the United States, there is this tendency to kind of put it all as investment that's monolithic. And I think that we should, whenever we take a look at that, we should unpack it a bit, because you have a lot of diverse actors in this. You have small companies, you have large companies, you have, in the Chinese case, you have private enterprises, and then you also have state-owned enterprises. Within the state-owned system, you have some companies, some state-owned enterprises that are more driven by the market economy, some that are less, some that have political direction. But we are still seeing a lot of projects come into the United States, and they're coming in under the radar, in many cases, even masking their national identity, purposefully not even going for state-level incentives that are basically provided to or offered to different companies of different national origins. So when I took a look at this question, I was basically, you know, the market, you know, you have the invisible hand of the market at work, and firms adapt. So the question that I was constantly thinking of is, for how long will these Chinese firms adapt to this suboptimal climate, and at what cost are they adapting? What my research shows is that the market is being tempered in these very unique geopolitical ways, and that you have local actors actually doing that. It's not just the federal government that is creating these restrictions.
Thanks, Emily. Justin?
What Emily has been studying, I think, is important to kind of frame what I'd like to add here. And then I think in terms of dependency and control, dependency theory and colonial relations historically has been a very important point of contention in geopolitics. Where should manufacturing be located? The unequal relations between various countries in terms of advanced manufacturing, or where cheap labor is or raw materials are extracted. I think today this still is very much a part of how everyday people experience politics writ large, particularly the question between the US and China and investment in various countries. But even today, it's still a lot more complicated, a lot more complicated, or a lot more complex. I think I have three ways. First, I think scale. Local city revenues have long been tied to major actors, but this is increasingly becoming an important issue to contend with, as you have these, as I mentioned, major data center firms or high tech firms that have spent a lot of capital in a particular area and often become one of the largest drivers of revenue for utilities or for taxes in small localities on peripheral urban spaces. This creates a very uneven relation of power, both between the city and the company, and creates also a different kind of power relation between the state, which cares a lot about that particular company's investment, with local cities and rural counties. On the international front, you also have the owning of assets, infrastructure assets, by major financial actors like BlackRock, Blackstone, etc., who have a very interesting relationship with the United States government and the Federal Reserve, which I think scholarship has not really dove into very extensively, but that has a sort of neocolonial sort of rhyming quality to it. And then second, I think what happens when you have these massive investments in both infrastructure, the security rationales, the competitive rationales, you have the rewiring of not only the focus of state and local institutions towards those things, but the shifting of the institutions, new commissions, new laws that enable either the territory to be invested in so that companies will invest, but also to sort of manage and put importance on these types of activities. And third, once these investments are made, they begin to create durable infrastructures that have political effects. Because they're fixed in space, whether a company stays or leaves, that thing that's left over or still exists there has to be dealt with in some form or manner. It creates, you know, whether it's a substation that is in a particular location or water canals, etc., that have particular geographies, those are physical things that later forms of investment and plans have to contend with. And one thing that we're concerned about in the United States recently is, given the expansion of AI and data centers, there's been a concomitant expansion of the energy system and concern over whether AI demand will pan out and what will happen to the kind of stranded assets of those energy systems if demand doesn't pan out as the way it would, and which would leave a major revenue gap in utilities and cities in the future, creating a whole different dynamic that states and local jurisdictions will have to deal with.
Right. That actually also takes me on quite nicely to a slight shift in the question. The next question I wanted to ask, which is really about how, so we was just talking there about how these new infrastructures and sites, data centers, et cetera, obviously impacting local states and government, but I'm also kind of interested in how these emerging forms of automation and digitalization are actually reshaping urban governance kind of itself, really, like the actual, not just the infrastructure, but the actual processes of automation, digitalization, how are they also reshaping urban governance? So, let's go to Simon again and then.
Yeah, thank you. I think sort of urban technology studies has been really quite effective in understanding the role of corporate, big tech, and sort of commercial actors in shifting urban infrastructure from an administrative model to a more operational real-time model of continuous sensing, predictive analytics, and automated infrastructure. But I think what's been missing from that has really been about an engagement with the sort of military security debates in geopolitics. And I think there's a really big disconnection between our understanding of infrastructure as civil and as security and military. And that disconnect, I think, has become, it's much harder to sustain, I think, when one starts to look at the debates about dual use technologies that are taking place in military procurement, when you start to look at the role of the of infrastructure geopolitically in terms of competition between China and the US, this disconnect is a problem. I think we need to think about civil and military deployment together. You know, I've made an argument that that sort of linear model of military first, civil is problematic. But I think we need to start rethinking how do we unpack. The increasing involvement, I'm really struck by the increasing involvement of military and security service investment in new technologies, in neurotech, organoid brains, AI, robotics, human-machine teaming. These technologies are of strategic significance and are seen of significant military value. And I think whether you look at those specific sorts of urban infrastructures or you look at the technologies that are needed in data centers and AI capacity to support them. So, you know, urban areas are becoming like testing and conditioning grounds for these complex geopolitical questions. Cities provide scale, diversity, everyday exposure to these technologies, and they're increasingly refined and normalized in urban contexts. And I think that's a really significant challenge to urban technology studies that hasn't really adjusted to this, the role of these actors and the role of these pressures. There's a blurring of boundaries taking place that there's the distinction between civil and military, public and private governance and security, I think, becomes increasingly difficult to sustain. We need to sort of be more focused on the continuous transfers and recombinations that are taking place across those domains. And just one example, if you look at the history of automated vehicles in an urban context, the crucial role that DARPA, a key military agency in the US, played in the early development and continued development of those technologies is absolutely crucial. And I mean, we have to acknowledge differences between China and the US. I mean, in China, there's this fascinating idea of, they call it military-civil fusion, with cities acting as coordinated platforms, where the distinction between civil and military applications of neurotechnologies, of AI and robotics are absolutely blurred and really interesting. The US, I accept, is a much more indirect process. It's mediated through large technology firms, platform ecosystems, and the state often taking a role in procurement and partnerships rather than the sort of direct intervention. But I think urban infrastructures are simultaneously civil with latent security assets as well. And that's the shift that I think I, as an urban studies scholar, need to engage with critically and systematically.
Mm. Interesting, yeah. It does remind me, though, of the nuclear industry as well, which has always had that kind of sort of two-way relationship between the civic and the military, going back, obviously, to even the First Cold War. But yeah, it definitely like really interesting point of that kind of civil military connection. So Emily, I just to come to you with that question as well then about the how forms of automation and digitalization are reshaping.
In regards to automation and digitalization, unfortunately, this is kind of where I have the least to say. But that being said, I have seen some of this play out in my research, particularly when it comes to economic development and the incentives that states and even local level governments provide for manufacturing companies. It used to be that states provided incentives for companies that explicitly provided jobs, and basically the higher wages that were provided, maybe there were more incentives, or the more jobs that there were more incentives, especially, you know, when it comes to tax breaks. And now we're really seeing a change in what states are going for and how they're going after these companies and really where they're wanting their economies to develop. And we're seeing this change in the types of industries that states are competing for. And this is outside of, you know, I focus on China, Chinese investments. But this, I would say, just is with international investments, just in general. A lot of these investments are capital intensive. They require fewer jobs. And really, most importantly, they're strategically important. Interestingly, you saw Governor Whitmer from Michigan really throw a lot of support behind Gotion and CATL, which are battery plants. Even though that there were Chinese investments and could potentially kind of blow up in our face politically, which they kind of did, but these were, in her mind, strategically important green energy and would also assist in establishing Michigan in the forefront of EV manufacturing. So moving from the auto sector, the auto sector with the gas guzzlers into the EVs. Interestingly, even Fuyao, that the glass factory that was featured in the very well viewed and acclaimed American Factory documentary, at the end, it hinted that automation was kind of making an impact at its Ohio plant and really questioned the long-term sustainability of the Fuyao glass. Interestingly, Fuyao not only has its Ohio plant, it has a Michigan plant and has a South Carolina plant. And the Wall Street Journal recently published an article showing that Fuyao is actually outcompeting its local competitors, and that this is creating a lot of tension in Ohio in particular. So what does this mean? I think that this really brings up very new questions for economic development and how states are viewing economic development, where it used to be, okay, we're just going to focus on our jobs. Now they're really thinking in regard to other incentives and other ideas.
Yeah, if I could maybe allude to some of what Emily studies and kind of tie it to the question of data centers in the United States today. I think there's been a kind of conventional economic development rationale for many decades that has largely focused on bringing jobs to places as kind of the headline political rationale, things that, you know, politicians would bring to their constituents and say, this is what I'm doing for you. But with data centers, because a lot of the facilities are very automated, some of the rationale is starting to shift, or at least focus on a completely different thing, because data centers don't bring that many jobs. Most of the operations are completely automated, and massive facilities will usually only employ dozens of people outside of construction, which construction is very temporary. And they've been focused more on that revenue generation aspect, being able to bring revenues to localities that often have had major job centers during the Cold War. A lot of these places where data centers are arriving at had, you know, huge manufacturing plants, steel plants, aluminum plants that have left throughout the 80s all the way into the 2000s. So these facilities are now coming into those kind of places and being kind of trying to be thought of in a different way. But what I also wanted to link to is some of what Simon was saying with dual use. One of the kind of critical questions that have just become increasingly pertinent for cities to concern themselves with is the data center bombing in the Middle East with the US and Israel war on Iran. Iran had struck several of Amazon's data centers, which hosted both military operations as well as many civil functions throughout the regions, enterprise functions throughout the regions. So the question of, you know, where do you host this data? How commingled is it? Can become a concern for cities that might not be able to decide whether they host their data services on the same place that military hosts their operations. I think turning data centers into critical infrastructures kind of opens up a whole nother line of questioning that I think cities should take into account. And then finally, I think the last point is just on manufacturing itself outside of the data center. I remember seeing a lecture by Eric Schmidt about one of the reasons that semiconductor production could be brought back to the United States is because they've been able to automate more and more aspects of the fab production. And I think that might go for a lot of other manufacturing industries as well. And this links very nicely to the question of AI and AI's use within industrial systems. And I also believe this is also more on the speculative side of things, but Jeff Bezos has recently announced a fund to acquire manufacturing assets and automate them. So I think questions of whether the jobs and economic development as we've seen it so far will still be a useful rationale, or what else might come outside of the concern for revenue. Because now, as we've seen in the United States, that rationale has not really picked up very well within the public.
Thank you. So I've got one question that struck me, and maybe it's not an obvious question, but from talking about both the change, this kind of civil-military relationship, the kind of, I guess, the idea almost that like people as... almost like as a little, you know, a laboratory in a city, right, for some of these technologies. Thinking also then about and what Emily just said there about states, and I guess also Justin as well, you kind of both really talked about how states, cities are trying to view this kind of infrastructure, almost competition, right, about how it is they locate in their locality, etc., whether it's about jobs, whether it's about their place in a network, etc. I guess what I wondered is, almost like the bottom-up question, which maybe I can, is like how do you think these infrastructures, their deployment, are both shaping how like citizens, let's just broadly say, or non-state political actors are able to respond, able to shape these things? Is it all, you know, these top-down corporations that no one could fight against, or is it like, Is there a kind of both like a set of responses coming in like to these infrastructures, but also obviously utilizing some of these infrastructures, right? Because these our lives are obviously heavily digitally mediated in particular. So is the securitization of that, for example, like closing down that possibility? So I guess that kind of set of questions really I'm interested in is like, what is the shape of kind of challenge to this? Is it too obscure, right? Like, I mean, this kind of civil military kind of distinction, right? Is it just too blurred? So yeah, I'm interested in the sort of ways in which people are challenging these things and the role of infrastructures, I guess, within their attempt to do so. I guess, Simon, do you want to have a stab at that? We can go around.
Yeah, yes, thank you. I mean, both Chinese and US military are really interested in the role of neurotechnology. I mean, neurotechnology is a way in which you integrate the human brain into technological systems. They're interested in that technology because one of the issues they have is it takes humans time to type on keyboards. It takes humans time to sort of interconnect with battlefield control and communication systems. And they're really interested in neurotechnology because it would enable humans to actually speed up decision-making processes. I mean, they already use these sorts of cognitive technologies in cockpits. They can use them to control robots. These are passive systems that use monitor electrical signals in the brain. Both Chinese and US military are really, really interested in these technologies, but they're also aware there's going to be a huge degree of suspicion among civil populations about military-first use of these systems. I mean, some of these systems involve actually integrating the human brain physically using very thin wires into these technologies. Some of them are passively based. And in China and the US, the playbook on the sort of civil use of these technologies is very similar. They both prioritize what I think you would call good neurotech. These are neurotech that's used in medical settings. And these technologies can be really transformative for people who have locked-in syndrome and other sorts of illnesses and disease where these technologies enable them to use computers, robots, to control a wheelchair, to feed themselves. And it's no accident, actually, the military are interested in this because large numbers of military soldiers suffer severe cognitive injuries from bomb blasts. Actually, a lot of the medical sponsorship has been through military funding of these technologies. And you've also got big tech interested in these technologies, Neuralink, Elon Musk's neurotech company. And I think what's interesting is the sponsorship and promotion of these technologies, in a sense, to precondition civil populations to normalize their use. They can be used to help you concentrate, to help you sleep. These are sort of non-medical commercial applications. I use one that claims to help me concentrate by increasing blood flow to my frontal cortex. And I think you can see a way in which these technologies are trying to be sort of introduced into everyday life explicitly as a precursor to their widespread use in security and military settings. And I think this is a really structured pre-social conditioning. And I sound like a bit like a conspiracy theorist when I say this, and I've actually been quite shocked myself at the similarities, or the institutional context is different, about a particular way in which these technologies are represented as socially useful and good and beneficial. And I think we really need to get inside these processes to expose them for what they're ultimately about, which is enabling the development of cognitive infrastructures that are really about creating ultimately what's being described as super soldiers who have enhanced cognitive abilities. And it starts in a very normalized way. It's really quite disturbing. And I think we don't give enough focus on what's happening with these processes and the way in which they normalize particular sorts of technological capacities, which have really widespread political implications.
Okay, well, that was absolutely terrifying. Emily, do you want to add to that, or to this question of kind of resistance or challenge, even on a geopolitical level as well, right? If people can articulate if the kind of interconnection of the infrastructures opens up new possibilities too. But yeah, I'll pass that general question to you.
Yeah, I'll focus more on some of the resistance that I've seen. So in my 3 case studies in my dissertation, it's interesting because they all ended up having very similar outcomes, where they deprioritized Chinese investments and they turned to Taiwan, but they had very different trajectories in how they got there. And they had different actors that played important roles in different ways. And one of the things that in 2 of my cases, citizens actively inserted themselves into the broader space of geopolitics, which is really fascinating to see. And you see the securitization of Chinese investments, you know, in part because citizens are doing this. But this brings up all of these other new questions, which is citizens, how do they engage in this geopolitical conflict? And where do they get their news and their information from? In some cases, they get their news from, you know, very negative sources. And then it kind of creates this echo chamber of fear and fear mongering that goes back and forth. So that's on the citizen level. And then I'm also fascinated many times by local politicians, and who also are inserting themselves into this geopolitical environment, because local politicians, that really isn't their forte. Their forte, typically the reason why they get involved is because they're trying to solve local issues. So inserting themselves into the geopolitics, they often, even if they have the right motivations, they don't necessarily have the right, maybe the right isn't the right word, but they don't have the prerequisite knowledge that, say, an expert would, or that a federal level politician could, you know, call up and get background information to make certain judgments or vote certain ways. They're basically going in, I think, many times very blind into this. Yes, they have a lot of agency, but how does this play out? And I think arguably we're even seeing some dark money playing out in more recent days and why certain things are getting passed at state levels and whatnot, even with this local agency. When it comes to the politicians at the local level, I'm often questioned, are they responding to local constituents? Are they trying to signal upwards like, oh, I'd be great at this next level? look at what I'm doing when it comes to foreign policy and protecting people, is it actually that they're interested and concerned in the outcomes? It's really interesting to see, and I don't know how it's going to play out, but I have many examples, and there are fascinating stories for sure.
Yeah, that is interesting. And the local politicians trying to make a name for themselves as well, potentially. Justin.
So you see a comparable situation in the United States with data center politics. Over the past year, I think the media has really been captured or has investigated this problem. In many localities, a lot of communities have begun to resist data center siting at different stages of the projects. But what has also happened is the data centers themselves, we've talked about the jobs question, them not providing a lot of jobs. Their water and energy use have become a significant point of contention for many communities, but also pollution and noise, that has become a significant problem. But in addition to that, we've seen more of association of data centers with geopolitics, both, I would say, domestic geopolitics, as well as the kind of international thrust of geopolitics, because many of the major hyperscale firms like Microsoft, Google, et cetera, are building a lot of these data centers to host AI or computing platforms. They've also become important military contractors, providing a lot of services to the military, a lot of which we don't really know exactly. And so a lot of the protests that have taken on some of this messaging and really related the expansion of data centers to the U.S.-Israel war in Iran, but also Israel's attacks on Gaza and the use of many systems that were either hosted on these data centers or supported by many of these firms like Amazon and Google, et cetera. And then that has extended very cleanly into the domestic sphere with immigration enforcement and the role of ICE in using these kind of AI-based or extensive surveillance platforms that also, of course, run on all of these physical systems and are associated with the same companies as well. So I think when you look at the emerging kind of data center politics in the United States, they've really sort of taken on all three of these kind of spheres, the impacts to the local community and questions of what benefits they actually bring, but also, foreign policy and what the US and its major companies are doing and being associated with, and as well as the kind of violence that is happening on US soil regarding immigration enforcement and the protests there.
Thanks, Justin. So I would propose that we close there. I mean, luckily, this is not going to be the last episode of the series. There's going to be many different aspects. Unless any of you have a final remark or like you want to say something in closing this episode. If not, I'd like to thank you. Thanks, Simon. Thanks, Emily. Thanks, Justin. And thanks, Garrett. This was such a great conversation. I learned a lot about dual use and neurotechnology, which I'm still kind of terrified by, but I'm wrapping my head around it, about the agency of local actors, about the strategic use of data infrastructures. Join us in the next episode of this mini-series on corridors, logistics, and circulation, where we will be joined by John Silver, Jasnia Sharma, and Luis Quizuzo to bring yet another part of the bigger puzzle on cities and geopolitics for us. If you liked today's episode, please share it with your friends. Send us an email. If you have podcast ideas or would like to be involved, please drop us an email. Thanks for listening.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website, urbanpolitical.podigy.io.